This podcast may have explicit content and also has this implicit request. If you follow me on Twitter, why not follow The Gist at Slate Gist? It's Tuesday, November 6th, 2018. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca, and this is a liminal time. From dawn until 6 p.m., we wait. We get those same reports of turnout we always get. Better turnout in Texas than even the last midterms, when David Alamil was challenging John Cornyn in the Senate race. Broken machine here, long lines there, some dissuasion here. We don't know what it means until we're finally told this. The first polls close at 6 in Indiana and some parts of Kentucky. And then we're off to the races about these races. But can I just say, with the omnipresence of the phrase, the first polls close in Indiana at 6, it seems no one has stopped to note this simple fact. 6 is way too early. It's way too early for the polls to close. Polls in New York stay open until 9, which is a sensible time because people work in America until 9, or at least 8:45. Now, in Indiana, they do have some form of early voting, but in Kentucky, they do not, and polls close at 6. So let's say you leave work by 5:30, has to be on the early side for a lot of people, hit a little traffic, no vote for you. It's closed. What closes at 6? My barber is open until 7. My kid's school stays open till 7. What with play rehearsal and orchestra practice and the enfranchisement of the American people, who closes at 6? With all the repression, suppression, dirty tricks, bad ads, and bad faith, we don't focus enough on the fact that it is too hard to vote. Not because of special means, just because of the regular means, like only on a Tuesday. Oh, and by the way, in Kentucky, fun fact, actually, horrid fact, a quarter of the black population cannot vote. They're not allowed. They're permanently disenfranchised. One of the few states that does this, lifetime disenfranchisement for felons, which means that the people who get a say in governance in Kentucky are the white people and three quarters of the black people. And by the way, among black men, since they have a higher incarceration rate than black women, it's got to be, I don't know, upwards of 40% of the black men in Kentucky not being allowed to vote. Did you know that Mitch McConnell was first elected senator in 1984 by a little over 5,000 votes? And back then, 75,000 black Kentuckians who could have voted against him didn't. So political scientists went back and they factored in, you know, non-voting and the few felons who would have voted for a Republican. And they figured really convincingly that Mitch McConnell never would have been elected that first time to the Senate if there wasn't this disenfranchisement. Thank you, disenfranchisement. For Mitch McConnell. There was some reform in Kentucky. Felons were allowed to apply for the right to vote again. And the seriousness that these applications were taken with waxed and waned based on which party was in the governor's office. In 2001, the restoration process got simplified. But then, listen to this. In 2004, the Republican governor, Ernie Fletcher, required all ex-felons who wanted to vote to submit a written essay why they believe they should receive restoration of the voting right, and also to provide three character references. And guess what? With the essay requirement, disenfranchisement increased. Imagine the governor grading these essays. Well, let's see, dangling modifier, no vote for you. Vivid similes, he can vote. Crazy. We spend a lot of time thinking about the people who win the vote, and very little time and attention caring about who gets to vote. In Florida, tonight, they have a constitutional amendment on the ballot. Amendment 4, if it passes, would give all felons, ex-felons, we should say, if the felony is non-sexual in nature and if they aren't murderers, give them their right to vote back after they've served time. This amendment has been polling at 66% favorability, and we will know the results when the polls close at 7, which, if you ask me, is a little too early. On the show today, I spiel about a topic that few get into. Mistakes that I have made while voting. Not levers, but actual people I chose to vote for incorrectly. But first, a sort of sorbet, or maybe a bold gobble of veal shank. Because what I wanted to do was I figured would be inundated with politics, and the politics that you would want are the results tonight. And I can't provide that to you now. So I say save and savor this interview with Mimi Sheraton. She is absolutely delightful and insightful, the doyenne that everything that goes in our mouths. Mimi is 92. I visited her in her Greenwich Village home. She has been a resident there since, I think, the Eisenhower administration. We had a great talk, and I've been chewing it over for quite a while. I'm sitting here with Mimi Sheraton. We are in Mimi's home. Mimi Sheraton is a legendary food writer, which I think we could trot out the word, the adjective legendary, when you've been at it as long as she has. Mimi is in her early, a spry woman in her early 90s, and I've just took a gander at her kitchen, and I have to report, no food island. Maybe we could get onto the idea of the food island and how that's changed. You should know that in the Sporkful podcast, they will be featuring a few episodes based on the popular live show, Ask Mimi, and you will be able to ask Mimi all your questions based on food and entertaining because, you know, food is about a lot more than food, and so is Mimi's career. Thanks. Thanks for having me to your home.
Well, I'm delighted to have you here. Welcome.
So I did, thank you. I did check out, a little surreptitiously, check out your kitchen because I wanted to know what an august food writer, what she stocks. Lots of pans, more pans than I thought I'd see, many in copper.
More pans than I thought I'd ever have, many of which I used to use. I don't do much cooking now, but to be very honest about it, my husband, who had he was an importer of all kinds of kitchenware and dishes, and he had a line of copper, and when he closed the studio, it was really easier to bring it home than ship it back to France. So that's why I have so much. And you'll notice it's not polished.
Right. Yeah. But that's good. It gives it, let us say, literally a patina of authenticity. So let me, you know, I've seen your live show a couple of times, and it does strike me that you are asked as many questions about entertaining and sort of sociology as you are food. So here's a hypothetical question. Would you rather live, let's say it's science fiction, and it's either a world where food doesn't taste totally bland, but just food in general doesn't taste as good as it does, but you have the entire social interactions around food? Or another scenario would be that food tastes wonderful, just as good as it does now, but you have to eat every meal alone. Which would you prefer?
That's a very, very tough one. Because I am eating almost every meal alone unless I go out. And the meals I prepare are a hell of a lot simpler than what I... But I'm not sure how bland the first choice is.
Okay.
Because you didn't say it was totally bland.
It's okay. It's like old bread tastes no better than Wonder Bread and...
Oh, no.
You know,
no.
Your vegetables are kind of those out of season vegetables where a tomato has the somewhat texture of a tomato, but not the burst of a really ripe tomato.
I guess every once in a while I'd have to eat alone.
Yeah.
Have a tasting, you know, meal with flavor. Or I would go out or send out to where it could come in and be good.
So tell me about when you got your, what was your first paying gig writing about food?
My first paying gig was, I was on 17 Magazine. And I was the home furnishings editor. My first field was design, New York School of Interior Design and that. And I shared an office with the food editor. And she left. And they said, and they, the editor knew I loved to cook. And then I potted around in the kitchen. She said, why don't you do that too? Because it's not such a big deal on 17 and you can do food and home furnishings. So I did.
What year was this?
Let's see, I joined them in 49, and I would guess in about 51 or 52.
So in 1951, was their notion of a 17-year-old essentially someone about to become a wife?
Oh, no. No. 17 Magazine, which began about 7 or 8 years before I joined it, was the dream of a woman named Helen Valentine who wanted a magazine for teenagers, not college as Mademoiselle was or Glamour. It had to do with a fashion size that was a teen size.
Okay.
And the way she ran the magazine is you never grow older with your reader. When your reader, you know, you do... freshman, sophomore, junior, but you don't do first year in college.
Mm-hmm.
You keep going back to the earlier grades because that's your market. So it was very much a teenager.
But back then, a teenager would be interested in furnishing? I don't know that.
Fixing her room.
Okay.
How to paint unpainted furniture, how to make curtains, how to spatter paint. But what was important, and this will seem incredible, they had, in middle America, hope chests, Lane Cedar Chest was one of our biggest advertisers, and the girls would register a silver pattern in high school before they had a boyfriend and start collecting silver. It had more silver advertising than any magazine, including House and Garden, House Beautiful, Vogue. They picked out china patterns, glass, and even more crazy, sheets and blankets.
Yeah.
And that was my department. Decorating table settings. There were teenage table setting contests in department stores all across the United States. I would go as a judge.
Oh, wow.
So that was home furnishings.
Now, and how old were you when you were writing for the teenage set?
Well, I was born in 26, so in 49, I was 23.
Yeah, so not that much older than the Reader, but you had a little
but
bit of
experience.
But very
different.
Yes.
I mean, a New Yorker, a
yes.
Brooklynite, a Hope difference. Chest. What? A Cedar Chest was where you put your blankets in, yeah. in the summer, you know.
And what kind of food issues would in 19...
Party cooking,
yeah.
cakes to
so
bake.
So what was a popular party dish to make in 49 for a teenage girl?
They did a lot with ham butts. They did a lot with pasta, baked macaroni and cheese with some. There was a feature called Every Crowd Likes.
Uh-huh.
And every month there would be one dish that every crowd liked. And once we got a new editor who was a little out of tune, and she suggested to me, she said, why don't you do Every Crowd Likes Those Little Fish? I said, you mean Every Crowd Likes Smelts? She said, yes. I said, I don't think so. Teenage kids, smelts. And then we would do, you know, for Christmas cookies to make as gifts, yeah. candies to make as gifts. The diet was separate. There was a separate writer on health and diet, so I didn't have to deal with that.
So did you sort of age out of the magazine? Did you want to write for an older, more mature audience?
I did because of home furnishings. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wanted to do, and I left to become the managing editor of House Beautiful Supplement Division, which was a series of magazines partially based on material in House Beautiful and partly original, most especially a quarterly called Guide for the Bride. It was a bridal magazine. So I was back with the silver and the china and the glass. But and then I freelanced for about 20 years
yeah.
after that.
And so you became the food critic for the New York Times.
The first place I became the food critic for was Q Magazine.
I remember Q. That was an insert in New York magazine.
No,
right?
That was much later when New York bought it. But it was a separate freestanding weekly.
Yeah, and they would have listings.
Listings.
Yes,
and the listings is the reason that New York Magazine bought it. And
I
the
see.
Woman who did the listings went to New York. She used to live across the street, Florence Fletcher. Then after Q, for various reasons, about 3 or 4 years, I stopped that and went to the Village Voice, mm-hmm. the original Village
yeah.
Voice.
So is food critic the same as restaurant critic?
Yes. Yeah. Well, not entirely, because I critiqued a lot of food that wasn't restaurant,
mm-hmm.
which is the best butter, which is the best, what you can tell about salmon or caviar or what you can tell about an egg before you break it open. I did a big story on that.
Given that platform, do you think that you made any food trends that we're still living with?
No, but there were restaurants that are still riding on that, like Rao's, like The Palm, a little bit like Chez L'Ami Louis
yeah.
in Paris.
You really championed them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of restaurants tell me, you know, still now, I remember as far as products, there used to be a wonderful bakery on 3rd Avenue in the 70s called Bonté. The baker was Maurice Bonté. And at one point I decided, I haven't seen lady fingers in a long time. I love lady fingers. Who makes them? So I found a few packaged kinds, and then I went to Bonté. And they always had lady fingers because you need them if you're going to make a Charlotte mold. Because
okay.
a Charlotte mold is lined with lady fingers. And I bought some. They never knew who I was. I bought some, and they were delicious. And I wrote about them. And Maurice Bonté later told me for 5 years, 1/3 of all of his sales were lady fingers.
Wow.
I thought that was, you know, I generally looked for the little old thing, and it turned out that other people were longing for that too.
Right. One thing I wanted to talk to you about, your hatred of kale. I think it's a bold stance in 2018. Defend yourself.
Well, there are a couple of ways I have liked it, as I said in one of my first columns for the Daily Beast. One of the problems with kale now is the way it's prepared, raw or grilled or in a lot of things like brownies or something it doesn't belong in. There is a fantastic Portuguese soup called Caldo Verde, which is kale, potatoes, merguez, sausage, onion, and it's cooked down to a soft, creamy, lovely state. When the Italians or the Southerners cook kale, they cook it with a lot of grease. Yeah. Italians would do it with olive oil and garlic, but cook it soft. And in the South, it would be ham hock or a piece of salt pork. It has to, and the Chinese would do it with oil. It has to absorb the oil to be soft. And when I was a kid, in winter, all of the greengrocers kept the kale outside so that it would freeze, because the idea was once a vegetable like that freezes, the cell membranes or cell walls, in the case of kale, are broken open. Because, you know, when something freezes, there's moisture and it expands.
Yes.
So that would break it open. Then when you cooked it for a long time, it was very soft.
Yeah. I am a little suspicious of any food stuff that has the same organizing principles as the George Washington Bridge, that it expands in cold.
A lot of food does.
I'm going to guess that you're a big fan of ice cream over frozen yogurt.
No.
No?
I never even heard of it till this very minute. Ice cream over frozen
yogurt? No, you prefer ice cream to frozen yogurt.
Oh, and
that'd be a great dish.
I thought it was a new kind of sundae.
Ice cream, then frozen yogurt, then syrup.
You better be careful. A little whipped cream on top
of
that. I much prefer ice cream.
Of course you do.
I like yogurt, but I don't think I have ever bought frozen yogurt.
Yeah. Are there any candies that you like?
Yes, I like chocolate almond brittle.
Okay.
I like very bitter, thin chocolate. I'm not a big fan of bonbons, although I've just had a box from Jacques Torres that were wonderful because they were all thin and just had little crunchy fillings. I like frozen Milky Ways. When I wrote my book, my last book, which you may know, 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, the first two things I wrote down that I was going to put in it were frozen Milky Ways and caviar.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the range in
that
the book.
Those are the ends. You're defining. Oh, yeah. That's really good. Yeah. So as you tell me about working for 17 Magazine, then working for the different publications that you've worked for and New York Magazine, it does seem to me that a case can be made that your career has to some extent tracked our society's definition of women in the kitchen, what women should do in terms of, like you mentioned, the diet editor. And I'm just wondering from your vantage point, how you look at this moment and what we're talking about in terms of our relationship to food, our relationship to body, and our relationship as a society to, you know, how important cooking and providing for the family should be for a woman.
For a woman. Why not for a man, too, providing for the family and cooking? I don't believe that everyone has to love to cook or be good at it. I think a parent's role is to provide a good meal for the children, whether they make it or buy it prepared. I don't have any strong feeling, especially at a time when both parents are working. So to denigrate someone because he or she doesn't like to cook and isn't a good parent, therefore, is something I don't believe. I believe send out or buy or do something for a good, wholesome meal. And the most important part of it for a family is eating together and talking about your day and what's happened. I think one of the very good things that's been happening is the more credit going to female chefs.
Right.
That, I think, is a step in the right direction. I was the first woman critic at the New York Times.
Of any section? Of any?
No, of the food, of the restaurant critic.
Yeah.
And when Craig Claiborne left, he was the most famous one, who started restaurant criticism at the time. I applied, like a lot of other people, and the word was out from editors at the paper who went out to play, they wanted a man. And the editor of that section was named Charlotte Curtis. She was a tremendous feminist, and she wanted only a man for that job. I think there was kind of a cachet or a style in having a boulevardier who could bring something to it. So three critics later, all men after Craig, I was already writing for New York Magazine, and the Times called me and said, would you come over? And I said, well, I want to be the restaurant critic. And they said, well, John Cannaday still is, but he's not going to keep it very long, and it's yours when it, and that's what happened.
Yeah.
So it was 6 months later, John, when he went on vacation for 4 weeks. I did the column for 4 weeks. He came back and said, you're so much more serious about this. I'm going to. And he was the art critic of the paper. So he had another big job. And the restaurant critic was sort of a sideline. It wasn't considered a job in and of itself. And I always wrote for the food section. None of the critics at the Times now do food articles, but I would do how to tell the best caviar or how to make something. Or, I mean, I was in the Wednesday section all the time, though my reviews were in the Friday section, in the weekend section.
Mimi Sheraton, in addition to hosting a bunch of episodes on the Sporkful podcast, is also the author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, which makes a great Hanukkah or Christmas present. And we should say it ranges from caviar to Milky Way and everything in between except for maple syrup. Thank you, Mimi. Thank you, Mimi.
Thank you very much, Mark. It was fun.
And now the spiel. No one ever cops to systemic mistakes they make in how they vote. Oh, you'll hear one or two times someone admitting, you know what, I mistook the measure of the man or the woman. You know, he said he'd do this, or she said she stood for this, and they didn't, so I got fooled. But that paradigm doesn't mean you made a mistake in how you conceive of the vote. It means you made a mistake in who you trusted to execute your vision. Now, there's another phenomenon, which is the I used to be a liberal, now I'm a conservative, or vice versa. It's not actually, though, when you think about it, an admission in a mistake in how you vote, because each time you vote on the candidate who aligns with your convictions, and what changed was your convictions. And by the way, this is pretty rare. How rare? Well, a guy like Max Boot just changed his convictions and got a pretty good book deal and like 2,000 retweets out of it. Here's a sample recent tweet by Max Boot. Sean Hannity is to journalism what Donald Trump is to conservatism. Okay, fine, fair enough. 3,931 likes. That's insight. But we do make systemic errors in terms of how we decide to vote. Not necessarily who to vote for, but my God, I've been voting based on this, and that was a mistake all along. I would like to admit a couple of mine. One, I think, was more of that first category. I just underestimated a candidate. But one, I do think, and it led me to rethink the way I conceive of who would be a good candidate and who I should vote for. So I'll disclose who I voted for. I think I voted for 5 Cuomos in my lifetime, 2 Marios, 3 Andrews. The Marios were better, no regrets in general. 1 Giuliani, also, good mayor. I'll fight you on that one. I cast a ballot for 3 Clintons. I'd rank those Clinton votes good, great, and could have been great, especially given the alternative. You know, I did like George H.W. Bush, but on the reelection, Bill Clinton definitely earned my vote. And then, like I said, 2016, not really much of a choice, right? I voted for Gore. I voted for Obama 2 times. I did not vote for Kerry because I covered that race extensively and I was on his bus. And I just thought that if I was covering the campaign, I didn't want to cast a vote in that election. For similar reasons, I never registered as a Democrat for many, many years while I was covering races. But that changed after the 2016 election. Republicanism seemed a maladaptive behavior, even on a professional level. Here are the 2 votes I regret. I haven't gone through all my votes. I might have voted for Pataki. I don't know. It was a simpler time. But one vote I regret was voting against Michael Bloomberg when he ran for mayor the first time. Why? I just figured this guy's a billionaire. Billionaires think they can apply business principles to government, and they usually can't. But he did. He really kind of did. He was a fantastic mayor, in my opinion, and I eagerly voted for him the next time he ran. And it really changed how I thought about voting. Also, you have to factor in my idea that his opponent, Mark Green, I think he would have been a pretty good mayor. I think it would have been a lot like de Blasio, pretty much down-the-line liberal, which was a nice change of pace after Rudy went a bit daffy and dictatorial in his obsolescence. But now we come to my systemic failure. For an example of true systemic failure, before I get to mine, let me play you a clip of Michael Moore, self-appointed patron saint of blue-collar Midwesterners. He was on the Chris Hayes show on MSNBC yesterday.
I think that what's going to happen in Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania tomorrow is essentially what happened 2 years ago with Trump. Things haven't gotten better in the Rust Belt. Things are still pretty bad. You were there. You've been there more than once. The way that they used Trump as a Molotov cocktail in those states to blow up the system that had hurt them and not made their lives better, I expect them to do the same thing tomorrow, except in reverse fashion.
Interesting.
Things haven't gotten better in the last 2 years under Trump. They know what that tax cut really was, and they haven't seen any of the results of it. They know that their life is not better, and I think for the same reason, because they want change and they're going to keep throwing that Molotov until they get it.
This is lunacy. Does Michael Moore not get that these voters are wrong? Did Chris Hayes not think to interject, well, actually, voting by Molotov cocktail seems ill-designed to bring about effective governance? I get that by voting for Trump, they did get government by Molotov cocktail, which is to say incendiary and with connections to Russia. But this isn't even building a plane while it's in flight. This is bombing the plane while it's in flight. So congratulations to the hardworking, earnest Midwesterners who think of elections like Hulk thinks of things. Hoosier smash. My systemic mistake was Rick Lazio. You remember Rick Lazio? He was the Republican nominee for Senate in 2000, and his opponent was Hillary Clinton. And I overreacted to the idea that she was unqualified, that she had never held office before. She went on to surprise me with her skill and her political skill. What I realized was she gleaned a lot of lessons by actually being in politics without being an elected official. I didn't see that at the time. I recalibrated. I took that into account. I didn't make her jump through extra hoops that I would have any other elected official. She proved herself pretty early on as a very effective senator, and I voted for her for re-election. So what I did was I calculated, I acknowledged, and I tried not to repeat my mistake again. I think almost no one does this. But you know, between the red-hot fire that was Rick Lazio and the cooling saucer of a Molotov cocktail, I do trust that good election decisions will be made out there tonight. Or at least we won't lose any fingers along the way. And that's it for today's show. The Gist was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader, who prefer ice cream over frozen yogurt, over Snickers, over peach compote, which is for Daniel a ranking, but for Pierre an actual dessert. TJ Raphael is the senior producer of Slate Podcast. She wants you to know that polls don't open in Idaho until 8 a.m., which, if you're a lark and not an owl, that might be too late for you. The Gist. Will we hit the midterm record set in 1914 for turnout? That was the first year that America directly elected their senators. I don't know. Do we really need direct election of senators? Without direct election of senators, Beto O'Rourke would simply be a local El Paso legend who shreds on his Stratocaster and nails ollies on his longboard. You know what? It's not a bad life. Un peru, dat peru, du peru, and thanks for listening.